Session number 4841, Reel 3.
Ruin GPT Reel 3.
But we did, of course, actually steal a lot of things. Although the Japanese never missed them, one of the most remarkable things was, as I mentioned previously, about the little group we got together to play concerts and so on. And there was a Captain Rogers of the American artillery who was also interested in music, but his particular hobby was cabinet work. And one day I said to him, had two violins and two guitars, there was no bass tone to our little band, and he said, if we could see how a violin is made, I think that we could make a bass. So the Australian Dr. Brennan had a dentist's mirror, and we poked that down through the sound holes of a violin and turned it around, and Captain Rogers then said he could see how a violin was constructed, and so we decided to make a double bass. And to get the size of it, I stood with my hand in the attitude of a man playing the double bass, and we then found that that was about twice as high as a guitar, and the men stole boards off the wooden huts, and we steamed those in a sort of a drain pipe thing that we made. And to cut the story short, we did actually make a double bass. And as far as I know, that was taken back to America when the thing came to an end. But the biggest problem we had with the bass actually was not making it, but was the strings. Because I expect you know, to get the depth of tone, you've got to have pretty good tension and some very lusty sort of strings. And the first thing that we tried was that one of the men managed to get a roll of a gut for stringing tennis rackets. And we tried braiding it and twisting it and so on, but we couldn't get the depth of tone. And at this factory where the men worked, the Manchu workforce was paid partly in kind. They were actually given food as well as money for their pay. And one of the chaps managed to steal the complete guts of a pig or pigs, and that was brought back into the camp. And I think somebody had worked in a leather factory, they knew how to cure it. And we made the bass strings for our double bass out of pig's guts stolen from the factory. And if I go on just one moment, it's recalled in the most amusing incident to me. Because the men were, the Chinese workers were fed or given food as well as money, every so often a railway wagon would be shunted into the siding of this factory. I don't think I mentioned before, it was called the Manchu Kuo Kikai Kabushiki Kaika Kasha. And one day when the men were given the job of unloading it, they found that it was full of these big red sausages, polonies, I think they're called. Well, what happened then was, because we wanted the sausages, or the men wanted the sausages just as much as the Chinese, they realized what they looked like, and so they set a truss of straw on fire somewhere nearby, and it sent up a lovely cloud of black smoke, and they started shouting fire. And the Japanese are petrified of fire because of all the bamboo, etc. And they all rushed to this fire, whereupon every one of the POWs who was in this factory descended like a horde of bees on this railway wagon, and each ran out with one of these polony-type sausages, which looked, when you've got a fire going, and if you run towards the fire, it looks like one of these pistol-type fire extinguishers. And they cleared the truck in a matter of a couple of minutes or something like that, and every single sausage had disappeared. And the Japanese were left facing an absolutely empty wagon, because nobody, although they ran towards the fire, they all ran on past the fire. Now, these sausages were all hidden away somewhere or other. Again, I didn't inquire too deeply into it. I had a laugh out of it. But later, they were selling these sausages in slices back to the Japanese camp staff in tracing paper, greaseproof paper, which they'd stolen from the drawing office at the factory.
Could you tell me next something about the general camp administration as far as the POWs were concerned?
Well, there were about 1,200 Americans in the camp to only 100 British, Australian, New Zealanders. And so that I had a word with their senior officer, who was a Major Hankins, and we mutually agreed that as they had by far and away the greatest number of people, that he had better be the nominal chief, because although we have the same rank, you could only have one person looking after the POW side. But on the Japanese side, of course, they had the camp commandant, an adjutant, a doctor, and various other officers who appeared as orderly officers from time to time, doing the roll call and conducting searches and all that sort of business. The Japanese were responsible for the rations and the clothing and the accommodation, such as it was. But I think that I'd not yet mentioned that after, I suppose it must have been about 6 months in the Hutted camp, we moved into a camp which they had built specially for POWs, two-story brick-built blocks, a bit like warehouses, but at least they were solid, and they had double glazing. But in the winter, the interstices used to fill up with snow completely. So my role as senior British officer, as I saw it at the time, and after all, you can only play your cards as you see the hand that's dealt to you, was to keep everything as smooth as possible between the Americans and ourselves, and also to try to get the best conditions I could for the men for whom I felt personally responsible. And a lot of this was really badgering the Japanese for more food, more clothing, more soap, or anything which we felt was being neglected. I'm continually trying to get more of it. We were not entirely self-supporting, but the Vatican gave us some seeds, and so we had a little garden plot and grew some vegetables there for the benefit of the vitamin C. Well, the work was done by our POWs, but the Japanese took it as rations, or included it into the rations. We had one of our English fellows who was a real farm boy, and he looked after a pig, which had been bought out of money given by the Vatican. It was in pod, and it had, I think, 16 piglets that all died almost straight away. But then we had another pig, but that, you see, again, became part of the camp rations. We did have piglets later on from the second sow, but when the Japanese said, kill a pig, then that was their side of the administration, but our fellow would do the butchering and then go on into the cookhouse. And I remember on one occasion, it was a Christmas, and there was quite a sizable pig. I think that it had been bought in the market. And the Japanese said, would we mind if they had some of it? And what we got was the head and the 4 feet, and the Japanese officers mishad the pig. That was the way the administration worked out. And there was also, I won't call it corruption because it's the Japanese way of doing things, but I'll give you an example of the sort of way the Japanese administration worked. Round about the first week in January, we were supposed to have one piece of soap issued to each man, which was supposed to last a month. Well, we didn't get it in the first week, so I went to see the Japanese quartermaster, and full of apologies. We've just been doing our annual stock taking. You shall have the soap as soon as possible. And I think we got it about the 10th of the month. So when we arrived at February, still no soap. Again, I went to see the quartermaster and asked for our soap. And the answer I got was, but you had it on the 10th of last month, and a piece of soap's supposed to last you for a month. So you don't get your next tablet until the 10th. All right. We'll go up to the 12th. We're all very, very busy, and perhaps we got the tablet of soap on the 13th. Same thing would happen all the way through the year. So that by the time you got to being entitled to your December issue, you were actually getting a belated November one. And the Japanese quartermaster had something over 1,000 tablets of soap, which were worth 10 yen a piece in the black market, so we were told. And that was his income. We also found that this system ran right through the Japanese hierarchy. A Japanese major at that time got about £4 a month. And the Japanese philosophy was that if he hadn't got the wits to make something for himself to augment his income, he hadn't got enough wits to be a major. And we feel sure that, or we did feel sure at that time, that all those officers there all paid the commandant something for having the position. And probably the camp commandant himself had to give Kumshaw to the general above him.
Give what?
Kumshaw, we use. Well, it's the Chinese word for backsheesh, payoff. There seemed to be a whole system of you paid somebody for the privilege all the way up the job. Well, there was little that I could do about it except to see as deep into the Japanese mind and their way of working things and try to use that to our best advantage. And when I made a report to the War Office when I came back, I did say that I thought that we'd been lucky in being one of the better camps after I'd heard from other officers and other men who'd been in other camps how they had been treated, particularly, of course, those who were on the railway. So whether it was all for the best or not, it's very hard to say looking back after 40 years. Sometimes I wish I'd done this or I wish I'd done that. But you can only do what you feel is right at the time.
Could I ask you, concerning the role of the senior British officer, you said that it was to, as far as you could, defend the men, and ask for alterations in your conditions from the Japanese. But did you have a regular meeting arranged with the Japanese authorities in the camp, or did you have to arrange each meeting as you wished?
The second alternative is the one that really operated, but I always wanted to see the camp commandant. I believe going to the top when you want something done. But you always had to go through the adjutant. And if it was anything that he didn't like, of course, you just got a blank refusal. Absolutely like trying to get past a prime minister's secretary or something like that. And it was only when the colonel came round in the camp, which did occasionally happen, that you could speak to him direct or through an interpreter. And the other occasions when I would take the opportunity would be when one of the men had done something amiss, a violation of camp regulations, and was called up before the camp commandant to be admonished, reprimanded, or sentenced in some way or other. They always had me there too, and I always said, you shouldn't punish this man for anything. It's my responsibility. They're my men, and I'm responsible for them. Then you should punish me. Because I had found, in their mind, this question of taking responsibility. It's the same, you know, as losing face. It was always a good line to play. I mean, I might have known nothing of what the chap had done. And sometimes there'd be nothing worse than he'd been having a surreptitious puff of a cigarette behind the labs. But if he was caught and pulled up in front of the camp commandant, I was always there too, and I'd often take this opportunity to get in a request and say, well, now we've finished with that, may I just keep you for one moment, honourable sir, and ask for, could we have a little more this, that, or the other, whatever it might be. That was about the only way that I ever really got past this adjutant. I think I mentioned Mickey, the one who was shot in or executed in Shanghai. He was a particular obstacle. In fact, you might have thought that he was really running the camp, because he was the camp adjutant, and he was out on the parade ground and that every day. And he spoke a little English, and he certainly understood more than he spoke. But anything that you wanted from him, you just got to spit in the face.
Literally?
Yes, oh, he spat in my face several times.
When you asked to be punished on behalf of the men, did they actually do that?
No, never. I never suffered anything at all. Thank God.
Not even beatings?
No, I didn't. No, personally.
You said that you described the way in which you had to address the Japanese. What was their requirements as far as etiquette was concerned from the POWs?
Oh, every time the men passed a Japanese, they had to bow or salute if they had a hat on. And sometimes a man would get beaten up for not doing that. I remember the case of a certain private Rimmer who was carrying a bucket in each hand, and he walked past the Japanese guard, and he sort of bent his head in a half a bow, and the guard then promptly beat him up with his rifle butt on the spot for not having put down the buckets and saluted properly. Had to great respect to Japanese soldier, as they always used to say. But again, there's a sort of system of etiquette. Once you could get hold of it and could comply with it, I mean, you were supposed to bow to a Japanese officer, but then, after all, the Japanese do that themselves, precisely to 15 degrees from the vertical. And so you get in the sort of way of doing it. I mean, they started off saying, you must bow, and I said, well, I only bow to the king. Oh, same as you probably do to the emperor. I said, I have no objection whatever to saluting a senior officer, that you're a full colonel. I'm a major. I certainly salute you, superior rank. But I don't like bowing. Must bow, Japanese way of life. So we all dropped into it. It's like going to France where you shake hands with everybody you meet. When you go in the office, shake hands all the way around. It's just the way that they do things there. But another thing that was curious is that when you want to be particularly polite when you're talking to anybody in Japanese, you breathe in as sharply and as loudly as you can with a funny hissing noise, you go, before you speak. That shows that, you know, the breath of the person who you're going to address is almost sacred. Great respect to suck in like that. So instead of going and saying, please, I want some more eggs in the ration, you go, may we have some eggs in the ration. It sounds stupid, but that's the way you get things done, is by going along with thou, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. And must never look down on anybody. This was unfortunate for us, because all the Japanese were shorter than we were. And that was one of the reasons why so many of them disliked us, because we all literally looked down on them. And so one or two of them insisted that when you walked past them, you sort of ducked your knees and went at a lower level. And they used to do it to their own senior officers. The lieutenants all ducked in front of the captain in front of the major in front of the colonel, because you mustn't overlook it. Look down on anybody. And of course it was pretty hard for some of our chaps to get hold of this idea that they would get a smash in the thump between the shoulder blades from a rifle butt or something, and they'd not have the least idea what it was for. But it was because the Japanese thought he ought to have come to a slightly lower level.
Was anybody ever seriously injured by these beatings?
Yes. Not of my men, though. But there were two or three Americans who were very badly beaten up and who did die as a consequence.
Was this beating with hands or weapons?
Well, it was very sometimes with rifle butts and sometimes with baseball clubs. The Japanese seemed to have several baseball bats, or whatever you call them.
Could you tell me what relations were like between the different nationalities which comprise the POWs?
Well, it took some time to sort out. There was one chap, one Australian, that I got to like very much in the end, but he'd committed some sort of misdemeanor, I think some sort of pilfering. And so we were still carrying on in the British Army way, so I had him up, and he said, "Oh, we don't like you limeys, we Australians, we don't like you limeys." So I very nearly said, "Well, the feeling is mutual." I just said, "I'm sorry about that." But he was completely anti-British, as some Australians are, very, very sort of Republican. But he became a very good friend in the later end. And one Australian, I remember particularly, when we marched from that hutted camp to the new purpose-built camp, I was struggling with my few positions in a kit bag, and George Harris just took it from me and carried it. I always remember it. And the New Zealanders we got on with much more easily. And the Americans, again, it was yes and no, because there was such a large number of them that there were so many different characters there. There were some who were that nice sort of gentle farmer type. There were some who were really cowboys. There were some absolute city slickers, could run any racket that you could think of. And do it successfully, too. But most of them were pretty good-natured sort of people, and we got on pretty well with most of them. The only one person who I think was despised by the whole camp was an Australian who claimed he'd been a sergeant major, but we sure he never was. And he was known universally as the White Rat. Everybody in the camp called him the White Rat, because he got himself a job in the adjutant's office as a floor sweeper, and the interpreters, two camp interpreters, were always in and out of that office, and he used to feed them all the camp gossip. And I'm sure that some of these very rigorous searches which we endured, being got up in the middle of the night and all the everything you had being turned inside out, and I'm sure they were looking for something. In fact, I lost two diaries that way. And I'm sure that these searches were instigated by this chap we called the White Rat.
Why should he have wanted to have done that?
Curry favour with the Japs, you see. They used to give him cigars and cups of coffee and all that sort of thing. He got himself in a nice little job in the office. He was one of the very few people who was out for himself.
Was there ever any other instance of what you might call collaboration?
I don't think so. There's nothing that I ever knew of. There were cases where people were incautious and said things that it had been better if the Japanese didn't hear them. We managed to get quite a bit of news in, for example, and after roll call every evening, I started assembling everybody and giving them the news, which we managed to get. And then we found that the Japanese were at least highly suspicious that we were getting news in. So then I started restricting it, and I only gave the news to a few selected senior NCOs and let them pass it on to their mates that they felt they could trust, and we left some in the dark, just living on whatever rumours there might be.
How did you get the news?
This is another complicated thing. Of course, a lot of it was what you might call latrine rumours in Changi, but in Mukden, I had had a lot of trouble with a particular chap in the RAMC, who we nicknamed Pluto, and he was belligerent. He always say, well, now that we're all captives, we're this, all on the same level. I may have been a private, but now I'm as good as any colonel who's also a captive, etc. And he was such a pain in the neck to everybody that we all got rather fed up with him. And one day I got him on one side and I said, look, Pluto, what were you before you came into the army? And he said, pickpocket. And this was just what I'd been looking for. He was, I think, slightly mentally defective, but a very exuberant type of fellow. So I asked him if he could get any newspapers into the camp. And either from the factory workers' pockets in the cloakrooms, or the sentries, or the guards while they were searching, we used to get about 3 newspapers a week into the camp. And of course, because of the paper shortage, these papers were very, very thin, almost like the rice paper that you can eat. Now, going back a little bit, when we first became prisoners of war in Changi, the Japanese were trying everything they could to encourage people to learn Japanese. And Arnold Gregg, who was a New Zealand with me, officer, he had got a Japanese primer, and he set to work to learn Japanese. Captain Horner had been a tea planter in Malaya before the fall, and he had been used to talking to the Chinese boys and labourers on the tea plant, rubber plantation. So he had a certain grasp of Chinese, and I had set to work on Russian, partly because I'm interested in languages and it would give me something to do, and partly because I visualised that when the end came, we might possibly get back by the Trans-Siberian Railway. You couldn't imagine how the end was going to happen. So at any rate, about 3 papers a week, one might be a bit of Russian, a bit of Japanese, or a bit of Chinese, that was real information which we could get. And the way we did it was that when Pluto had picked the pocket and got the paper, at roll call he would pass it down the lines behind the people's backs, and we had a pair of boots in which we'd hollowed out the heel, and using the back screw as a sort of a fulcrum, you could take out 2 screws and swing the heel back and tuck a folded newspaper into the heel. And we had 3 men who could wear these boots, and so that nobody ever really knew quite who was the carrier. But Pluto was the man who pinched the papers for us, and one of these 3 men would carry them in, and then they'd be passed up, and either Arnold Gregg or Jackie Horner or myself would try and pick the bones out of the paper and then tell the senior NCOs what little we'd been able to glean. It was nearly always encouraging, because although the Japanese were always claiming victories, we noticed that the islands were always one nearer Japan than the previous victory. So we were fairly well informed that the American fleet had been destroyed 4 or 5 times completely, but it always seemed to turn up again a little nearer Japan. So we had a pretty good idea what was going on. We had the names of islands such as Okinawa, I remember in particular, or Bataan, I'm not sure whether it was Corregidor, Cabanatuan, and then Bataan, and then I remember Okinawa in particular, because I stayed there on my way back for a short time.
Was there any specific piece of news which really cheered you up that you can recollect?
Of course, the great thing was the atomic bomb. We didn't know it was atomic, but we knew that an enormous bomb had fallen and created havoc at Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
How did you receive news of that?
Well, we were all quite pleased. when we were first captured, so to speak, in this camp, they were raving about the co-prosperity sphere of Greater East Asia. And I remember saying to Mickey, you may have won the battle, the battle, but I said Britain always wins the war. You always win the last one.